I believe that we can really change the world for the for the better, is in the big or small part. So when I see people, they don't care and they're okay with being average, I get really upset.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 33. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. There's just two more episodes after this one before the season break. Today, I got to interview UX veteran Andrea Picchi. This was my first interview with someone from Italy, so I certainly appreciate Andrea staying up late to do this. Actually, now that I think of it, I bet he would have been up late anyway, fighting for his users. Andrea is a huge fan and master of design thinking, which you will certainly pick up on during our time. Enough talk. Please enjoy my interview with Andrea Picchi. Andrea Picchi has 20 years of experience in UX, UI, and product design. He combines his skills in cognitive psychology and computer science with his passion for UX and human-centered design to create integrated, multi-device experiences. He believes in design and connecting customer needs to business opportunities. He also practices Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. Don't mess with Andrea. How you doing, Andrea? Welcome to User Defenders.
Thank you for having me. I'm doing great.
I'm super excited to have you on the show today, my friend.
Me too.
Awesome. So as you know, we take a fun superhero approach, and every superhero has a secret identity and origin story. Let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments just to give us a look into your personal life.
Yeah, sure. Now I'm just lead designer at Sony Mobile, but I started many, many years ago in 1994 when I was a freshman in the university, just to looking for a job, trying to pay my tuition, and with a big passion for cognitive psychology. And that was my beginning. And after 5 years with another big love for computer, I just took a big leap of faith and start again and study computer science. Because if you think about back in the 90s, especially in Italy, we didn't have that things called internet. So when you were thinking about, what I should do with my life, I love psychology and computer science, people, they just say, you're crazy. They don't really get on very well. So there wasn't any way for me to just understand that my passion was human-computer interaction. So I started studying psychology and then after computer science. And then I started to put together and connecting the dots afterwards. And that was really the beginning where I almost gave up on both of them because I wasn't really satisfied until I started connecting the dots, studying human-computer interaction. That was really the beginning in a nutshell.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're kind of an early arriver at this stuff, because I know in the 90s, HCI was not really a thing. I mean, it was there weren't very many people connecting the dots with psychology and computers and users. So that's pretty neat that you've been at this for so long.
Yeah, and to be honest, I didn't know that I was connecting the dots or even in love with the human-computer interaction. I just felt that I was deeply in love with the computer, like a young boy that was born with the Commodore 64. But at the same time, I was fascinated by people, and I wanted to understand more about myself and more about how the people, they do what they do. So, and I saw that subtle connection between, if you interact with a computer, it's also about people. But back then, the vast majority of the people, they didn't see it that way. They say, it's just about machines, right? And I didn't know how to explain, but I knew that it was right. And, maybe now I'm lucky, but that was the right call.
That's awesome. And you certainly are doing a lot to give back to the community. And I mean, you're a speaker, you're a writer, you do a lot of mentoring, I gather, is what I'm learning, and definitely talking a lot about it. I love how you call yourself an evangelist of this work. And so I appreciate you doing that. And I know our defenders listening also are going to appreciate gleaning your wisdom as well from what you've learned these past 20 plus years in this field. So what do you like to do, Andre, when you're not working?
Well, I'm a very simple person. So the only thing I love to do, not just like to do, is to spend time with my girlfriend. It's called Simona. She's an Italian girl. And then training, because I love to train. And I consider myself like a hyperactive person. So it's a good relief for me to just release stress, and even passion sometimes can become stress. So I need that type of I don't want to say aggressive, but intense type of sports. Mm-hmm. And then I love to learn. I read almost one book a week.
Oh, wow. Really.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's inspiring, Andrea. And I love reading too, and I can never find enough time to read, right? But I feel like that's inspiring to our listeners, because we can learn so much if we just take the time to read. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you read one book a week?
So I just differentiate the way you read a book. So I don't read all the book in the same way. So if you have, for example, a huge manual and you have to memorize everything, like when you are in college, you have to go page by page and read everything and summarize and took your notes and then repeat or whatever technique you want to use. But for the vast majority of occasion, books, they contain one or two or three ideas, and then they elaborate. So you just have to learn how to scan the content, and then you just change the pace. Sometimes you read faster because you understand that it's not so brain intensive, and sometimes you slow down, and then you just collect some keywords, and just if you want to just follow up with your mind and your brain, what you memorize, but basically just to learn how to read, not in a conventional way, but in a different way.
I would love you to write a blog post about that and let me publish that, because I know we would love to learn from you on how you do that.
Yeah.
Andrea, who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
Yeah. Oh, superhero. To be honest, I don't have one superhero, because, and maybe we will talk about later, one of the things that I learned from martial arts is that you don't have just one professor or one master. You can learn, and you have to learn from everyone, all the people around you, and sometimes not even from people, from environment, from what happened to you. It's always about learning. So I don't have just one person, but it's, if I have to call out someone, for sure, Ethan Rance, because I love it the way he just pioneered the minimalist design, and the job that he just did with Brown was phenomenal. And in today's, I would say Johnny Ive. And you may thinking, this guy is just calling out industrial design more than digital designer. And let me tell you the reason, because I believe that as a digital designers, we have a lot to learn from industrial designers, because they have to believe and embrace the prototype mentality. Because think about it, if you want to design an iPhone or even a chair, right, you have to materialize your idea in some way. But when we start to think about digital design, sometimes we take the luxury to just discuss the design, look at a pixel, because they are quite similar to the final product, because they are still pixel in our phones, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not what we should do. We should always create prototypes. So that's why I prefer to be inspired by industrial designer, because And you will see that with design thinking, this is the tangency that is taking a lot of people's attention, because now the mentality is changing, the mindset is changing. But yeah, those two guys, for what they stand for. If you listen to Johnny, I really embrace two of the things that he repeats all the time. The first one is that the product that we create, they testify the care that we put in the process, and that the people, they can really perceive and feel beyond their ability to articulate the care that we put in the process. And I truly believe it. And the second one is that design is a show conversation. It's a conversation that you have initially with yourself, and then with your very inclusive set of people, and then with a lot of people. So just for those two point of view, I'd say, yeah, Johnny Ive over anyone else.
Definitely good choices, Andrea. I mean, those guys are legends. And I love that you mentioned industrial designers. I mean, you know, when we started doing this in the 90s, we were really putting all our designs on a CRT monitor. It weighs like 80 pounds, yeah. Right? And a 640 by 480. And it was just all computers. I mean, there really weren't a lot of laptops around yet. And there certainly weren't smart devices. And so I like that a lot, because I can see that you take a lot of inputs from many different places, and you find ways to bring that into your work. And I think that's inspiring. So, as we do continue to move forward into this future, where we're talking about virtual reality and augmented reality and artificial intelligence and all those things, I think that we're going to probably hopefully start seeing more physical objects interacting with our designs. So I think that there's definitely a lot of relevance there. So great choices.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have and they harness them for the greater good. And we all know significant transformation can occur through failure, as it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Can you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Yeah, well, there is so many. I mean, I'm the type of guy that really helped to fail as much as possible without losing a job. That's a between parentheses, right?
Yeah. I like how you caveated that.
Yeah. So because life, it's really about failing. There is there is also another way. By other people's failure, you can also learn that way. Sometimes it's the better choice, but most of the time, we don't have that luxury. So in my case, I guess probably the most relevant for the Andrea that is speaking today is that the first time that I was ahead of, because I remember I was very excited and I had a very good team. So as you can imagine, a guy that has so much in his book to put in practice, what I did was to just play by the book, everything from A to Z, like, oh, that this is the process, this is what we should do, because I believe it's the right thing, and from the previous years or experience. But what I realized was that basically, especially when we design something, is always about people. And what you have to do more than roles is having principle that you can apply. And doesn't matter if you are a scrum master and you want to just teach people how to be agile, or you are head of and you want to teach people how to be design driven, or maybe you are just the manager of NFL team, or maybe football or soccer player, you always have to interpret your principle in a way that help the people that you have to get, you know, or at least to do the best job of their life. So this implies to adapt your roles, but actually there are no more rules, there are more principles. So in my case was, I had a brilliant failure because I tried to apply everything really by the book. And I was a little bit too rigid because it was my way to show my passion and show what I believed I stood for. But what I didn't get was that every person is different and there is many, many ways to achieve the very same goal and the very same results. And I was too young, I was too excited about the role, and I really failed a bit. But at least I learned the lesson, so I took something from that, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. What do you want our listeners to take away from that, Andrea?
Yeah, definitely. So as a designer, you have to be... And if we will talk about design thinking, we will elaborate a little bit more on that. But as a designer, your superpower is to be able to be through ambiguity. Hmm. That comes when you try to explore, especially the qualitative side of the value. So as a designer, you have to be the guy that is comfortable with ambiguity. In my case, contextualizing my experience was to be comfortable with adapt to your roles, to the context that you have, and the ambiguity that comes back to you. You have to be able to just handle and managing in a positive way instead of in a negative way. So that's what it was, my humble lesson that at least I just try to bring with me, because it's super easy when you, especially when you start to struggle to go back to a role, right? Because give you confidence. So this is a role. If you follow that role, we get somewhere. But as a designer, the role is really to have no roles. Unfortunately, this is another things that I learned from mixed and martial art, because there are no roles. But yeah, the only rule is no roles. So.
Yeah, that's a very interesting answer, Andrea. And I think about embracing ambiguity. I mean, that's pretty deep right there. And there's a lot to kind of to really read into in that, and let into your life, right? Because I think we all have, as designers especially, we have very strong points of view, and we all have our own aesthetics. So for me, as I was thinking about that, I just like I know what I like. And I tend to design just what I like, and then I'm surprised when other people don't like it, right? But it's,
why you don't like it?
Sounds like you identify with that.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of our challenge as designers, right? Is to be able to stretch ourselves and to be able to try different things, and really, because it's about the client, it's about the business, and it's about the users, of course. But we need to really, I think that's a good lesson for all of us, to really try to stretch ourselves out and outside of our comfort zone of the aesthetic we like and the way we do things, right? So that we can really meet the needs of our users and the business.
Yeah, and definitely this is something that only designer, or at least, well, only it's a big word, but designer that are way better than anyone else to do that. And that's why we need designer. We need more designer. We can maybe elaborate later on that, but that's the main reason, because they can be comfortable with ambiguity.
Yes, that was awesome. So do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during user testing? We know that user testing in general is a pretty awkward experience. But anything that stands out to you in general?
There are many, and because... Yeah, as a designer, it's always a surprise when you see people using your application or your design, your web app in a way that is unexpected. And well, there is many. Well, but I remember even stakeholders say, "Why you do that?" Screaming at the mirror, right? Trying to say to convince the people through a mirror that he wasn't able to even listen to. So why you do that? That's not supposed to work like that, right?
Let me help you.
You're completely missing the point of the user testing. Yeah. It's not about you. It's about you. But what I want to share is that it was something that less funny, but it's something that was eye-opening in my case, because when a few years ago I was working for a gambling company, So we did a lot of user research. That was a very good thing. But what I didn't know, because it was my first time in the gambling market, is that basically there is a role that if you have a feeling that there is some addiction, and some people, you have to report that addiction to the right place. And you have to. It's not something that you can, oh, well, we want to do it or not. You have to by law, because, well, because the regulation in my case was in UK, the United Kingdom. And it, as a young, no young designer, but it was the first time for me, was very, very sad when the first time I realized that I was interviewing that person, and I started to realize that that person had an addiction, because he started to talk about his family and the money he was wasting in gambling. And for me, it was really eye-opening in a sense that I don't want to work in that market anymore, because I realized that a good design for me, a good achievement for me, was eventually something bad for someone else, right? Because it's by default, you go, I don't want to say dark pattern, but if you have to increase conversion and you're working in a gambling company, well, that you just connect the dots and you say that eventually that is not a good thing for someone else. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, it's a legal thing, but it wasn't the right thing for me. So, then I left and I never came back to that market. But that is not fun, but at least was uncommon type of experience, just to testify that, see, if we want to generalize that every time you interview someone, every time you jump into user testing, you really have to be open-minded, because you don't really know what is going to happen. And that's probably the big lesson.
So interesting, Andrea. And I recall what you were saying about this interview and the whole principle. I think, you know, for you, the principle of working for a gambling company and realizing that the people you're designing for have some serious challenges, and I think you had kind of a gut check on that one. And I, and like you said, I mean, it's certainly legal, and certainly, you know, people they can do that if they want. But what I think is a really big takeaway for me is that you didn't really realize the impact of your design until you actually sat down with somebody who was using it. And again, hearkening back to the importance of user testing and talking to our users. And for you, it was like, you know, I think I could probably do something a little more impactful with my design superpowers. So I think that's really great. I appreciate you sharing that as well. I'd like to ask you, speaking of superpowers, what's your design superpower?
I believe that something that I'm doing fairly well is to connecting the dots. And because most of the time what you have to do as a designer is do reframing. And to do that, you have to basically switch from a high-level point of view and a holistic approach to problem solving to a very low-level operational point of view. An example, we say, how can we, depends from the question, but if we want to deliver a design solution, we can initially start to think about it from a holistic point of view and try to get a bigger picture and try to understand if the solution is fitting the requirements, the needs. But then once we have an idea and we maybe came up with an hypothesis, what we have to do is to dive deep into that hypothesis to just stress that hypothesis, understand if it's something that it's viable or not, right? So as a designer, you have to switch up and down in this scale of problem solving approach in order to just be able to connect the dots, because maybe you just put together the wrong hypothesis. At that point, you have to step back and go back to the holistic point of view and for some people, this is a struggle, and especially for an engineer, for example, because they work a very low level. Or maybe for a businessman, it doesn't know, is very, very high level. It doesn't know to go down. And that's another thing why we need more design, because we are not the only type of person, but the more comfortable with this type of switching. So I'd say connecting the dot, reframing and switching point of view during the problem solving process. I consider, yeah, that's, if we want to call it superpower, that's probably will be mine. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. And adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
Yeah, that there is a danger that now I'm going to sound a little bit blunt, but but yeah, I can't really stand when the people, they don't care. Hmm. That's just, it's something that I'm working on, because I get really upset. Because for me, design is really, I don't want to say it's a cold, right? We are not curing cancer. Well, probably we can also do it if you work in the healthcare in some way. But I believe that we can really change the world for the better. Is in the big or small part, depends where you're working, on the big or small company. So when I see people they don't care, and they're okay with being average, that's just something that really, I'm still working on that, because I get really, I switch to anger mode, right? Because sometimes probably the only confrontation that I had in the past year, it was triggered by these things, because I start to have a different approach to people. Say, well, if you don't care, you can just leave the team. We don't need you, right?
Yeah, so, for sure.
Because designer, we are kind of romantic, and we want to make a difference. We want to go home and say, well, I play my small part in this bigger picture, huge picture. So, and when you meet those type of people, they're like an infection, because if you have one of those guys in your team, they start to infect all the people around, because it's super easy to be okay with average and just don't care. That if you can instill this, not the doubt, but this bad behavior, so instead of fortify people, instead of make people stronger, you those people, they make the people around them weaker. So, you have to get rid of, maybe give them a second chance, but then get rid of, like A people instead of B, C, and D people.
And I think that starts with the hiring process, right? Making sure that you vet the folks that you're bringing into the company, and making sure that they are passionate and they do care.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you, man. I'd never realize it, but I'd probably answer the question similarly to you, would be apathy. Right?
Yeah.
Just apathy.
Yeah.
And I mean, we spend so much time creating a design that we hope works, and obviously we test against that, but we spend so much time doing this stuff, and then when you have somebody on the team that maybe doesn't care as much, the output is going to reflect that, and it affects the whole team. It's, the weak link, the whole weak link thing breaks the chain and such. So it's, I totally agree with you, man, and I think that's great. Obviously, the more passionate people on your team, the better. But you can't always have it. There are no perfect teams, I suppose. But you can certainly, as a leader, you can certainly try to inspire excellence.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Because sometimes you don't have the luxury to hire your entire team. So
right.
But you can make the difference. I'm not saying that all the people there have that. I don't know how, I don't even know how to call it, but that type of apathy is because they are that way. Maybe because they are frustrated, because they never been inspired by a great guy. Mm-hmm. So you have to give them a second chance. But in Italian, we use a word we call the rubber wall. When you just try to go through something, but there is no way, because it's a rubber wall. You just bounce back. And those, yeah, that's something the way we say in Italian. We say, oh, this is a rubber wall. Because, like, say, there is no way to go through these things. And that is when someone doesn't care. There is no way for you to just make any or trigger any change inside that person. Because, like a good romantic relationship, it's both ways, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
the first question for you is, how I can make that person care? And that's why you have to be more a psychologist than head of UX or vice president or director or lead, whatever you want to call it yourself, than anything else. So it's always about people again.
Indeed. And I would rather not bounce against a rubber wall, but I'd rather break through drywall like Kool-Aid Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remember those commercials? You remember those? The Kool-Aid Man in the 80s?
Yeah.
Kids, look up Kool-Aid Man on YouTube. How do you say rubber wall in Italian?
Muro di gomma.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. What would your UX superhero name be, Andrea? I know this is hard to answer sometimes, especially with your humility, but, you know, I agree that I know that everybody I try to bring on the show, I know has done something, you know, to make themselves better and the people around them better. And every one of them, and I know you included, would say you couldn't do it without a great team. But but obviously there are superheroes on the Avengers and the Justice League. So I want to ask you, what would your UX superhero name be, my friend?
Well, I don't really know, but I can tell you what, that probably is something like the Dark Knight, even if we already have the Dark Knight, because it's Batman. But I guess it embodies what I believe a designer should be, not just because it's Batman, but because you should be behind the scene. You should be, because good design is obvious, right? And that's like a curse for a designer, because it's not like winning the World Cup. When you do something extraordinary, it's clear to everyone that you scored a great goal, or you won the gold medal, you break the world record. If you design the great design, it's obvious, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody is in notice great design because it's so obvious, and that's what we say is always obvious in retrospective. So that's why I say the Dark Knight, it means probably as a metaphor that as a designer, you have to be ready to just give your best and risk your life, but be okay with be behind the scene, because it's never about you. And you should stay in the dark, because when everything goes as planned, nobody will notice you, will notice your design. Then we just, you know, happy with whatever product they are using. So there is not that ego things that people say, oh, that's really great design I'm using. I'm feeling that this is so different compared to another one. No, they're just happy that they don't even notice. In Italian, we say that the best referee is the one that you don't notice during the match. Because, yeah, it's the same analogy, because you don't want to just be that guy, the main actor. In the same way, you don't want to be yourself or your design be the main actor. You just want to disappear and be part of the user life. So I'd say the Dark Knight to just embody that concept. Yeah.
Nice. I'm glad you explained that, because I wouldn't catch on to that if you hadn't. As far as but I'm glad you explained it.
This is Ben Callahan, the president of Sparkbox, and you are listening to the User Defenders Podcast.
So one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
That's a very good question, and that can lead us to why we need a chief design officer in pretty much all the company. Is because I believe the way we can do it is to just be the user advocate. So embodies the user needs. Doesn't matter if they are unmet needs, they are other type of needs. but basically remember and remind to everyone is that everything you do have to be based on user needs before even thinking about the KPIs, the way you shape your customer journey, the way you design this, the way you shape your hypothesis, the way you deliver, you test it, have to be based on user need. Because if you don't solve that need, you don't have a successful product or service. So from that perspective, I'd say I always try to defend, let's get rid of the try. I always defend the user point of view. In every conversation I have, always. That's my way. Because when you say, for example, why, for example, we want to deliver a feature and we say, where is the user value? What is the value added to the product? Well, but we can have this one because maybe we can get more money. So that this is should not be the rationale, right? We should think about if we have a value, then we can, you know, make someone else happy that eventually we buy or supply the product and those money, they are going to take care of the company. But don't think straight away about the money because otherwise you don't go anywhere. So my way is to just like be, yeah, the user advocate. So that's what is something that I do in every conversation I have every day in every context. For me, it's always about why we want to do that, why we believe this is good, why we know that this is good. So user advocate, yeah, will be my answer, definitely.
You are a true user defender, my friend.
Sounds very good to me, to be honest.
Yeah, I love that. And you're being the advocate for the user. And that's, you know, as you know, we're user defenders. We fight for the users. And so I love that answer, Andrea. That's awesome. I've got a couple little questions. I'm going to veer a little bit because you have definitely got a ton of experience. And you're doing some great work over with Sony right now, Sony Mobile. So I want to ask you, you said a couple things I saw either on your website, and actually one of them was you sent to me and the other was on your website, but one thing you said was design thinking is an essential tool for simplifying, humanizing, and innovating, and that it can't be extra. It must be a core competence. I definitely love that sentiment, but I'd like to ask you, what is design thinking and why should designers today be well-versed in it?
Oh, well, that's it deserves an entire episode just for that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's try to synthesize a little bit. But the first thing is, let me think of how can I put it, because it's really broad. It has been my focus in the last 5-6 years. So let's try to go straight to the core concept. So this. First of all, let me say something about the way of thinking. So we have at least three major way of thinking. So we have design, engineering, and business, at least in our context, like designer, industrial designer, digital designer. So you have the engineering thinking that we used to say that it solves its way through. And the reason is because as an engineering, what you want to do is to isolate all the variables and then manipulate those variables into an equation. And then what you want to do is to solve the equation. That's what the developers do. That's what the engineering they're doing. So, but you can understand that this type of thinking works very, very well when you know everything about the problem domain. And that's why usually we push the agile to the delivery phase of the process, because we assume that at that time we have some requirements based on some solid findings and reasoning. So, but especially if you want to be innovate or we want to explore new or uncharted territories, you don't have the luxury to apply that type of thinking because you don't know, right? For example, now with Sony, we are working on in the artificial intelligence space, and we are trying to solve problems that There is no history. We can't just look at Google and say, oh, how did I solve that problem, or Apple, because it's a brand new type of question. So you don't have your problem domain crystal clear, right? And then you have the business thinking. And we used to say that the business thinking optimize its way through. So what it does is just pick or maybe just isolate a set of solution, and then it just select one solution, then optimize that solution. Think about it. Oh, we have a product, we want to market that product. We can do it with this campaign, that campaign, the other campaign. Let's select that way, and then we just gamble on that one. We optimize, we decide to go with this channel, the other channel, and we go through the entire process. And then, but again, in order to apply that type of thinking, you need to have a solution. So again, when you try to explore an uncharted territory, you have everything, but probably not a solution. Hmm. So you can't really apply it. And the design thinking, we used to say that prototypes its way through. And this is good because in design thinking, it's a prototype mindset. But the prototype is just another way to ask question, right? So in an engineering world or in a business world, a prototype is just, it is something that is more consolidated. It's something that it looks like pretty much like the final product. They have alpha, they have beta version, but you don't see great changes compared to the golden release or the final one. In the design thinking, every prototype is just another question. Every prototype embodies a question and a hypothesis that you have to be brave enough to embrace, but wise enough to let go if it doesn't work. So why we say that design thinking it's a must-have? Because in 2016, with the market that moves so fast, that changed the entire landscape every probably year or through 2, 3, 4 years, completely it's landscape. The design thinking is the best approach to go through the ambiguity that comes with every market iteration, because now you have wearable and then you have virtual reality and then you have artificial intelligence that basically redefined the entire paradigm. So you have to be able to go through a huge amount of ambiguity, and design thinking is the best way to do it. But there is also another aspect, if I can elaborate a little bit more.
Sure.
It's that basically the design thinking is the best way to explore the qualitative side of the value, because we have at least five type of value. We have functional, we have financial, they are pure quantitative, and then we have emotional, we have the meaningful, and then we have the identity. Those three, they are the qualitative, the most relevant qualitative type of value. But today, those three guys are the guys that make and generate the more money, even if for the purist of the quantitative. Those three qualitative are the pillars. They are generate more money, they create more retention, they push more conversion. Think about Instagram, right? Instagram acquired by Facebook for 1.1 billion, right? If you remember, it was April 2012. But not a lot of people know that basically the book value, what the MBA guys call, you know, the real company value, was 85 million. And actually, even less people knows that 1 week before was 35 million. The investors, they just put 50 million the last week because they want to pump up, you know, the IPO, right? So if you think about it, say, why Facebook paid 1.1 billion for a company that had a book value of 85 million? Are they stupid? So, and the difference, it's all about qualitative value. It's all about the relationship that Instagram created with the customer base. Mm. It's all about how the people care about sharing, how the people they let Instagram be part of their life. Mm. And with the classic quantitative and classic MBA tools, you can't explore this type of value. You need design thinking, because as you start touching qualitative value, you get, hit by a truck of ambiguity and things that you can't really understand at glance. They are not crystallized, they are not crystal clear, and design thinking is the only way to just manage, shape it, and convert into a great product or service.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I love it. It was, I appreciate you. And I know that you, like you said, you could go on, this could be a whole episode easily, because there's a lot to design thinking.
Yeah.
But I think you did a fantastic job of giving us the kind of the 30,000 foot view. And I love that you told the story of Instagram. I hadn't heard that story. I didn't know that stuff about the value per, you know, versus how much was actually, it was bought for. But you're right. Like, it's that connection, that engagement, and good design, right? Kind of full circle back to, it was good design that made that company worth $1 billion, right? And it was good design, and it was user engagement and connection with the product.
Made
it worth that much.
Yeah, how much Instagram it's present in people's life, and we didn't specify, but when we say design, we don't refer UX or UI. Design is really a broader concept. So, yeah, I didn't specify before, but I'm sure you know that. But just for the people that are listening, design, it's really how you solve the problem from a broader perspective than just, not just because about the nice Instagram interface, but how they deliver the solution, how they brought value to people's life. That's what design is about me.
So good. Andrea, unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up here because I'm really enjoying talking to you. But, this is part three. This is segment three here, the 3-act structure of the show. And I'd like to wrap up the show with the imparting of superpowers. Okay, what's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
Well, I believe that... First of all, this is something that, again, I learned from martial arts. Consider yourself a white belt all the time, even if you are a black belt. Hmm. And it means that there is always something to learn. And in my case, is to always learning. If I have to summarize in few words, I'd say never stop learning. Because as we said, the IT or landscape changed so incredibly fast, but you have to evolve and to shape yourself in a continuous way. For example, when we started designing, probably in the 90s, was just about knowing the basics, right? How to use the program, how to, know the patterns, and then became be able to connect with the developer world. So we started coding, or maybe start to learn the language of or the tech world. What is a agile means? What is a user story? What is a method, a class? Just to interface ourselves with those people. But now it's the role of designer mutated again, and now we need to learn business because we start to have a bigger role inside the company. So this just to give you an example of how you have to, you don't have the luxury to stop learning, but you don't look at these things something like, oh, I have to keep learning. Should be really the pleasure is in the journey, right? Mm. Not in the destination. So it's something that you should enjoy. So for myself, it's never stop learning because it's pleasurable. As a designer, it's like I don't know, if you like something, you want to know more. If you want to eat Nutella, you want more Nutella. If you like pizza, you want more pizza. If you like designing, you want to design more and be a better designer and learn more. It should be a pleasure. So to me, it's really never stop learning, because it's simple as that. It sounds simplistic, but it requires commitment. It requires relentless attitude. And like a good design, the other part is to just not just come up with the idea, but to nail everything down and then deliver it. They maybe took 1 year or more than 1 year. That's the other part. It's, again, here, sounds simplistic, but I consider the holy grail, because, yeah, life at the end is it can be simple. Simple if you want.
I love that answer, Andrea. It is simple, but yet so hard. So
I agree.
Definitely inspired by that. Now, we know there's a ton of resources and a lot of really great ones and tools out there in our field, and it just keeps getting better, it seems. I want to ask you, what's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners?
Oh, tool. Well, again, it may sound simplistic. I don't think it's rocket science. If you have to connect with your user, so a tool that you can never, you always have to be prepared to use is to talk with people. So in the case of, for example, user research, it's interviewing people. I mean, there is a lot of things that you can do across with quantitative, but the qualitative side, and we just said before that the big value, it's hidden behind the quality, the side of the value. If you don't talk with people, you never get in contact with that hidden treasure and the value as a designer. So I'd say interview people, because interviewing people, it's easy on paper. It's really, really hard, because it's more about listening and try just to trigger what you're looking for without suggesting, without be self-explanatory. You have to let them people open. So it's like be a psychologist sometimes. So I'd say connect with people and find a way to communicate with them. In our case in point, it's interviewing. I guess if I had to pick one, that's interviewing people, because that's what you need.
Find the hidden treasures, defenders. I love that. That's so great. And you can't find them if you're not digging, right?
No, yeah. Absolutely.
Good stuff. If you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why?
Oh, from a guy that reads a book every week. So, yeah, I have to go classic, and I'd say Creative Confidence from David and Tom Kelly. It's called Creative Confidence. The guys there, you know, they are founded the D School at Stanford, IDEO, not the gods of design, but inspiring. And especially when we talk about design thinking, they prove to everyone that a designer has to be a master of the design thinking process more than the problem domain. For example, if we want to design a rocket, you can go to IDEO and they will put in place the design thinking process. They empower them to innovate, even if they don't know anything about how to build a rocket. You will have the subject matter expert. You will talk with the user. We talk with scientists. And that's, to me, it's something very, very obvious to me, but it's still shocking how it's an alien concept for the vast majority of people. The people that even if they try to interview, if you want to work with banks, you have to understand the banking market. No, as a designer, that is not what I'm bringing on the table. So Creative Confidence is something that can be a very, very good starting point for someone that is trying to be a good designer in the way we try to define and describe in this conversation.
Excellent. And I haven't read that yet. It's in my Audible queue. Definitely going to make sure that I listen to that, because you're the second super guest that's actually recommended that book. Yes, Drew Lepp recommended that book as well, episode 21. And that was a great interview. She's a great designer as well. So, so two great designers recommending Creative Confidence. I think that's enough endorsement for all of us to check that out and on Audible or buy it if you can flip through the pages as fast as Andrea can. Right on.
We talk a lot about books on the show and the tremendous value reading has on your career and personal growth. As much as I love the written word, and I do, until I have the Flash's superpower, it can be really hard to find the time to sit down with one, which is why I've teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is visit audibletrial.com/userdefenders. Get this, even if you cancel your free trial, you still get to keep your book and feel the warm fuzzies in your heart because you'll be supporting the show. I love my Audible subscription and I'm benefiting greatly from it. Might I recommend Design as a Job by Mike Monteiro or Sprint by the Google Venture Guys? Give it a shot and get your free audiobook at audibletrial.com/userdefenders.
This is one of my favorite questions because this is sort of why I do this show. Not sort of. I think this is really one of the main reasons I do this show is to help aspiring designers really stay inspired, because it's hard. Sometimes it gets really hard in this field. And there's so many things we got to constantly always be learning, as you said. So I want to ask you, what's your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
That's a great question. Well, I'd say probably two things. So the first one is you really have to have passion for design. Mm. Design is not something you can do just for the paycheck. Or if you don't believe in design, we don't need you. So that's the bottom line.
Wow.
We need people that believe in design. They do design and because they believe that we can, you know, change the world for the better. And they use design as a tool. But I know that the vast majority of design, they look at their job that way. But if I have to advise a young designer or even, you know, seasoned designer is to, from 2016 perspective, is to study business. Mm. Study business. Because that is what will make the difference in the next 10 years. I would say probably if you are in the Valley, 2 or 3 or 5 years. But if you are in Europe, probably 10 years. Because now, in 5-10 years, we will have a lot of chief design officer. And in order to be or to get a seat at that table, you need to understand business and realize that you have to talk a different language, that as a designer, you can solve different type of problem, that as a designer, you have a moment when you talk about your craft with your fellow designer, and then there is a moment when you use design thinking, and that actually includes, I didn't mention that, but includes design thinking, design doing, and design culture to solve business problems. Hmm. And that's is something that is not so obvious because, well, I'm a designer, should I study business? It's not something that you think about when you just wake up in the morning. But, there is, for example, a great MBA in design strategy at the California College of Art that I would like to, suggest to everyone that they are willing to take a couple of years sabbatical or whatever to just, go in that direction. So study business because we need designers that they can stand conversation in a business environment. And if I can, 10 seconds, I give you an example. Here at Sony, we had a problem with recruiting great developers, right? So what we did was to apply design thinking to that problem, that actually it's a business problem. How can we get more talented people on board? This is something, a very relevant business problem that, and we just applied design thinking. We interview people. We discover unmet needs, what the people want for their career, and then we just come up with a solution. And then we iterate the solution, and we put in place many different initiatives, and then we test them, we collect data, and then we increase the number of people that now we have on board in the company. So as you can see, we use design thinking not to push pixel, not to create a service, not to create a device, a product, a physical object, but to solve a business problem. And that's what great designers will do in the next, I guess, 10 years until the end of the world. That's what I believe.
You are taking us to church, my friend. Come on.
Let's go.
Come on. I'm like raising my hands.
Yeah,
brother.
Use a defensor? That's great.
Dude, so good. So good. I love you. You are very clear in how you communicate your passion, and you are so passionate, Andrea, and I love that. It's infectious. I know all of our defenders were just kind of raising their hands and saying hallelujah at the end of that as well. And but I mean, you say it on your website, and it's there's two things. One is by the early linchpin of design leadership, Thomas Watson Jr., the second president of IBM from 1952 to 1971. And he said, good design is good business. So yeah. I can't think of a better way to open up your website. And defenders, check out Andrea's website. It's awesome. And I also love what you say, Andrea, and you totally are embodying this. You say, I am, therefore I design. Inspiring.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love it too.
Yeah.
So as we close, and I've just had so much fun talking to you, and I was taking notes, and I haven't done that in a while. I was writing stuff down, you're saying. But why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
There is my website. So it's www.andreapicchi.it, like Italy. And then they can find me on Twitter. It's @AndreaPicchi. And they can find me on LinkedIn @AndreaPicchi. So it's very simple. And those three are my major point of contact: website, Twitter, and LinkedIn.
Very nice. And Andrea is Andrea, and then Picchi is Picchi. And I'll be sure to link to those in the show notes as well, defenders. I have a feeling that you're going to get some new followers and people keeping a pulse on what you're doing, man, because you are doing some awesome stuff. And just keep inspiring people. Keep your passion alive. It is truly infectious, Andrea. So I appreciate it. And I just thank you so much for being here today. I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Great. It has been an incredible pleasure to just have that conversation with you. So it's thank you very much for having me.
I remember tweeting right after this interview, Andrea took me to Design Church today. I hope he took you there too, defenders. I love his passion for design and problem solving, and it's hard not to catch some of that fire after talking to him and listening to him. So I was finally able to redesign the logo. I made a couple iterations, and I couldn't be happier with the result. I want to say a huge thanks to you defenders on the Biweekly Bugle who voted to decide on the new one. I did it in Illustrator, so it's way more scalable. The original was done in Photoshop. There's a lot more usage opportunities with this one. And I'd like to say that the logo was the holdup to actually starting to create things for you, but frankly, it's been work, running this show, and The Walking Dead. As I mentioned in the outro of the last episode with Sarah Duty, how I want to start making things for you, I am working on something finally that I think will be a great start. Stay tuned. I'm super excited about this, and I'll be sure to announce it before the season ends. In 2 weeks, I have a very special episode with Laura Hogan, where we talk all about her brand new book, Demystifying Public Speaking. This is a great one. You won't want to miss it. Be sure you're subscribed at userdefenders.com/subscribe. I want to thank Chris Combs for the extraordinary editing, Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork, and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. Thanks so much for listening, telling others about the show, and leaving a rating and review on iTunes. You are why I do this. Please feel free to reach out to me anytime on Twitter @UserDefenders, and if ever I can do anything for you, please let me know. And until next time, fight on, my friends.